Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 116 of I Wish You Were Dead, a podcast about things that used to be alive. My name is Mike, and that is Gavin. And Gavin, I think we have something to say to our third host.
We sure do. Happy birthday, pal.
Happy late birthday, Fia.
Thank you.
Yes, Fia's birthday was not today at the time you were listening to it, or even today when we're recording this, but a non-disclosed date in the surrounding area to not. Like half dox Fia.
Yeah. If Fia has a July birthday, and you go ahead and do with that information what you will, dear listener.
Exactly. Thanks, guys.
Of course, buddy. I know, and I can't wait to see you, next year at Hobie.
Yes.
I'm manifesting that. I'm saying that as often as possible.
Or sooner.
It's manifesting in my brain, too. Okay.
Yeah, we have a pretty exciting episode today about a group of animals that I think are real neat, and that Mike and I actually got to see in person.
Yep.
When Mike came to visit Liz and I in California a while ago.
Great experience of my life. Just one of the coolest things. Like, thought I was going to die. It was awesome.
Yeah, absolutely. And just because we didn't say at the beginning of last episode, I'll spoil it right now. We're going to be talking about ratites, which
I don't know what that means.
Sound like rats, but it is the group of birds that are generally seen as the giant flightless ones. There are exceptions to that, but that's generally the group of birds we're going to be talking about today, their evolution and all the various different cool guys we got strolling around the earth today. But before we get into that, Fia, do you want to keep some house for us?
Yes, of course. As always, guys, don't forget to rate the show on whatever platform you listen to. And to follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube to give us feedback about the show and any future topics you would like to hear on the podcast. And if you would like to be a guest on the show, be sure to fill out our guest form, and all of this stuff can all be found in the show notes below. As for next episode's topic, what do we have, Gavin?
So, I'm a little torn. I've decided we're going to be talking about an old guy, once again, doing some geologic history, but of like the humans doing the history side of it, and I'm torn between two people, so I guess we'll have you two decide which one we do, knowing no context
okay.
But either of them. So the first one is Louis Agassiz or Alfred Wegener.
I mean, as an American, and I hate anything that sounds remotely German, so I want to go with the first guy.
I was also going to say, I like the first guy's name.
Okay, Louis Agassiz it is. Still also European.
Where in Europe? Like, don't tell me this guy's French or something.
Switzerland.
I can live with that. Switzerland's cool.
Although, with an asterisk. It was technically not Switzerland at the time.
What was it?
He was born during the Napoleonic Wars, when it was technically some other like sister country to France.
Yep, okay.
Yeah. Strange things going on in Europe in like the early 1800s to mid 1800s.
I'm not sure why you had to put a year on that. Just, yeah, strange things going on in Europe.
You know, that's fair. But yeah, so next episode, we're going to be talking about Louis Agassiz, which is not spelt the way you think it is. However you're thinking it's spelt, you're wrong. that's French for you.
True. Awesome.
But with our house now kept, I guess we will go on to today in history, and today I think we have an interesting one, because Mike said he had an abundance of options for us, so he decided, especially since Fia said that Swamp Corn is relatively short this week, Mike's going to do two today in histories, because July, I guess, is just so jam-packed.
Yeah, so I was told, when I was looking through July 19th, I just kept finding cool things, and I was told pick two. But instead of picking two, I'm just going to rapid fire through some of these. Okay. So I've got four or five of them. 1692, five people are hanged for witchcraft in Salem, Massachusetts. Incredible. 1836, the HMS Beagle with Charles Darwin arrives in Ascension Island, which I think was one of the last places that the voyage went to. 1848, nice. The first U.S. Women's Rights Convention was held in Seneca Falls, New York.
Wow.
Home state represent.
Right, absolutely. Always incredible. 1910, Cy Young wins the 500th game of his baseball career. He's the only guy ever in Major League history to win 500 games. That's why they named the award after him, the Cy Young Award.
Crazy.
It was absolutely nuts. Apparently, this day is just fantastic. I'm a big fan of July 19th. That's all I got for you right now. I'm trying. Was that all? Yeah, we're gonna say that was everything. Oh no, wait a minute. We have one more. 1969. Apollo 11 goes into moon orbit.
Oh.
Wow.
Like, come on. It's incredible. Apps yeah. just. I guess a day. What an incredible day. No notes. I have nothing left. The rest of you guys do some talking.
Awesome.
Sounds good.
Man, July would not have been my pick for like a month that's like absolutely jam-packed full of stuff.
Come on. It's my birth month.
I don't know. You know, it sure is.
There's a joke to be made about how like December was actually the month where things were happening there for you.
I don't think that math. It might math. I don't know. I'm tired.
I didn't think that hard about it, but the joke landed.
All right. Moving on to Swamp Corner. Awesome.
Yeah, with Today in History over, thank you for that, Mike. Swamp Corner.
All right. The little swamp guy I wanted to talk about today is the grass shrimp, Palaemon vulgaris. And I wanted to talk about this because it is probably one of the most prominent organisms that I found in my research down here in the South. And just spoiler alert, I will be defending my thesis next week. Woo! So we'll be talking about some grass shrimp a little bit. But disproportionate to the amount of them that I found, there is not a lot of information about these guys. What I have is that they're in the family Palaemonidae, which are found all over the world. But this one particular species is found in the Atlantic Oceans from Cape Cod south and then throughout the Gulf of Mexico. They can grow up to about 5 centimeters, which is like 2 inches. So they're pretty small. And they're usually just transparent and they just look like little tiny shrimps. Nothing really special about them. They are forager detritivores, which means they eat whatever they find. And then I guess I was trying to figure out why these guys are so important. And what I found is that they are a key prey species for many commercially and recreationally valuable fish. I know that, for example, redfish is a common recreational fish down here, and they're a main food source for those guys. And so in general, they are important in transferring energy up the food chain.
Cool. It's funny, when I first read it in our sort of shared document here, so the genus, again, is Palaemon, which
yes.
I thought was interesting. I'm like, that sounds like a fossil Digimon.
And then Digimon, the
species,
wow.
Yeah, yep. And then the species name is Vulgaris, so then I just had like an image of it like swearing constantly in my brain.
Right. Well, I've been calling it Palaemontis, which is what it was called, but they renamed it recently, and I just found that out Googling this. Gotcha.
Okay, neat.
Yeah.
Taxonomy.
Was Digimon supposed to be just a Pokemon knockoff?
I don't quite remember which came first, but probably.
I'm going to find out here. It says 1997 until present. I'm going to do some reading.
So then, yes, that is after Pokemon came out.
All right.
Pokemon came out in Japan in 1996.
Apparently it was intended as the masculine counterpart to the Tamagotchi, so we're just like swimming in nostalgia for me right now.
Interesting. Huh. Anyway, enough Japanese culture. There are, I'm sure, many a podcast for that. That seems to be quite popular these days. We're going to talk about some big old birds.
Cool.
So...
I mean, I want to say how big, but I know you're going to get there.
Oh, we sure will. Although, spoilers, Mike, you've seen the biggest ones alive today.
yeah, I mean, you have visual confirmation that I saw those.
Yes. So, ratites are the group of birds that includes all of the big flightless ones that you're thinking of, and also a few others that we'll talk about. But what Mike and I are referring to is that when Mike came out to California, sometime... like a year and some change ago,
a year and a quarter ago,
to visit me when I was still living out there, we took him to, there's an ostrich ranch.
Ooh.
Nearby, an ostrich and emu ranch. I believe it's called Ostrich Land, in, I think, Solvang, California. And, we're gonna be talking about all things ostrich today. And, a fun thing that I like to point out with this group of birds is that they're commonly called ratites. I don't quite know where that comes from. I tried to look up the etymology of it, and I couldn't really find it. But that's just kind of what the big flightless ones are collectively known as. But that is not a scientific name. That is their common name, which makes it even weirder.
Yeah.
So that is the common name for the group of birds that are all very famous for a few shared features, namely their huge size and weight for birds, and their pretty unique lifestyle for being a bird. They do basically all the things that birds aren't supposed to do, namely not flying. So, as I mentioned, ratites refers to the group that is ostriches in Africa, emus and cassowaries in Australia and New Guinea, rayas in South America, kiwis, which the bird, not the people of New Zealand, which are found in New Zealand. And also, shout out to the roughly 1% of our listeners who are from New Zealand, because we'll be talking about your home quite a lot today.
Ooh.
And so what I mentioned earlier, ratites is what is called in taxonomy a paraphyletic group, meaning that it typically leaves out members that should be included in it, but don't quite like fit in with all the relatives, so it isn't often counted. And a really good example of that are whales and all of their relatives, which are hooved mammals upon land. So for example, the group is artiodactyls, you know, the even-toed ungulates. So that's your cows, your deer, hippos, stuff like that. But when people say artiodactyls, they generally are not meaning whales, because whales are so weird compared to all of the others. So there is one group in the ratites, or that should be considered a ratite, that is small and can fly, not particularly well, but it can, called tinamous, that live in South America and are perfectly capable of flying, but in sort of experimental studies, they very much prefer to not do that if they can get away with it. And same, I also like to not, you know, stress myself. So, some general ratite features, not including the tinamous, because they can still fly, so a lot of this stuff doesn't really apply. Just for context, tinamous kind of look like a slightly more slender turkey, without like the big plumage tail behind them. That's kind of what they look like, or kind of like a big pheasant, kind of. But all the other rat types are as follows. First things first, they are flightless, all of them. That's typically why the tinamous are left out when talking about the rest of them. Most of them still have their wings, but they're pretty much just used for display. For example, ostriches, particularly in their sort of mating displays, the males will spread out their wings and do like a dance with them and stuff. It's actually very entertaining to watch. And on the other end of the spectrum, kiwis have lost their wings pretty much altogether. The scientific name of their family means no wing.
Can we hold on? I apologize. I just want to back up, and I know this is normally my job to do this, but Gavin, I'm just going to ask you.
Sure.
Can we just define what a bird is?
Absolutely. Like, thank you for that, Mike.
Right. So I want to back up. If they're losing their wings. I know that some birds don't fly, but I imagine like just okay. I know it when I see it, but what is a bird?
Yes. Thank you for that excellent step back that sometimes we need. That's why you're here, Mike. Never.
The only reason I'm here.
Doubt yourself here.
Big clap for Mike.
Yeah. So birds. Birds are a group of dinosaurs that took their feathers and modified them for flight. They generally have wings. In fact, I think all of the living ones, some of the extinct ones kind of break this, but at least all the living ones have some kind of wing bones. Like I said, some fossil ones, you know, just like how snakes lost their legs. Very similar thing. They didn't need them for what they were doing with their life, so they got rid of them, because growing body parts takes energy. They are basically just a group of very advanced dinosaurs that, underwent a lot of adaptations to turn their feathers that they already had in, you know, previous renditions of dinosaurs, and co-opted them into first being able to jump farther, being able to glide potentially, and then to fully take to the skies. That is pretty much of a definition of a bird that we need. You know, there are other things such as most of them have what are called often hollow bones, even though that's not quite correct, but their bones have sort of spaces for air in them instead of the more dense sort of marrow-filled bones like you or I have as mammals. They all lay hard-shelled eggs, unlike lizards or turtles that all lay soft-shelled eggs. And I believe, naturally, I think there are some, like, domesticated, like, selectively bred chickens that don't have feathers, but all of them, to my knowledge, have feathers. They're the only living things that have feathers. But that is generally a bird.
And so you said that they pretty much all have wings or wing bones at some point. So what did you mean when you say that I believe it was kiwis you were talking about, now almost don't have, where's the connection there?
So because they're all flightless and terrestrial, kiwis do have the bones, but they are so very much reduced that you can't see them just looking at them. You have to sort of go looking. It's basically just like a little nub that you can't see through its kind of shaggy feathers.
So this would be like this is a vestigial bone at this point?
Technically, yes. As we'll talk about, I think most ratites have a very small external claw on their wing.
Ooh, okay.
That, to my knowledge, I couldn't really find what it was used for. Potentially for grooming. Particularly since none of them have a preen gland, which if you ever see like a bird reaching into like its armpit with its face and then rubbing its wings, it's getting oil from a gland under their wing, and then using that to oil up their feathers. Yeah.
What?
Yep, they use that to clean themselves. Ratites don't have that. They don't have that gland anymore.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Understood. Thank you for going back there and just clearing that up.
Yeah, absolutely. Ratites, because they no longer need to fly, they don't have a keel on their sternum anymore, so flying birds have this sort of big protrusion coming forward on their sternum. If you've ever like carved a chicken, that's what you cut the chicken breast off of, or a turkey. They don't have that big, you know, elongated section of their sternum anymore because that's where the flight muscles attach, and they don't fly, so they don't need that big section of their bone anymore. So you wouldn't really get like ostrich breast meat like you would find on like a chicken or a turkey. It's all drumsticks, baby. Okay. They generally have a large body for a bird. Ostriches can get over 8 feet tall and easily over 200 pounds. Most species of ratites average around 60 to 80 pounds, which isn't huge, but for a bird, you know, that is enormous. With the exception being kiwis. Kiwis are quite small, and we'll talk more about each of the individual sort of groups of ratites here in a second. Their bones are pneumatized to a lesser degree, which means they're not quote-unquote hollow like other birds. Although their femur, their thigh bones, still have air sacs like a typical bird, likely because that's the biggest bone in the body. Feathers are structured differently than in flighted birds. In kiwis, it basically just looks like fur. Even like under a microscope, it just kind of looks like fur, but is structured differently like at the root. So it's clearly like evolved from feathers. But in others, they lack sort of a true vein. So there's like the central shaft of a feather, and then the parts that come off of that sort of almost like Velcro together. That's called the vein. V-A-N-E, not V-E-I-N, like inside that your blood goes through. And so they don't have that Velcro-y part. So that's why ostriches, for example, look very fluffy and have very fluffy feathers, because their feathers don't like Velcro themselves to stay straight like you would need for a flying feather. And also their feathers don't need to be oiled like in flying birds. Because they use their legs much more for, you know, their only means of locomotion now, their legs are much stronger and the toes are generally much bigger and typically with fewer toes.
How many?
Yeah, so the default for birds is four, usually, with three that face forward and one that faces backward, sort of like a hawk that they used to, like, grab stuff. Some, like, woodpeckers have two that face front and two that face backward so that they can, like, grip onto the side of trees and things. But all ratites have reduced the one in the back or removed it entirely. So they just have the three forward-facing ones. Ostriches have gone farther and have removed the toe on the sort of inside of the foot. And so each, basically so they only have two toes, with the middle one being much larger. Similar to how horses have just like a single huge toe, which is an adaptation for like efficient running.
Mm-hmm.
Also randomly, they don't quite have like a secondary palate like mammals do. So in most, I think all reptiles except for crocodilians, when they breathe through their nose, it just goes into their same mouth hole. They don't have a separate, like, at least initially, like sinus chamber versus their mouth. It all just goes into the same thing. They sort of still do that, but a bit less than other birds do, which is where their scientific name that we'll talk about when we talk about their evolution, that's where that name comes from.
Are there, like, flaps that, like, close over the nose holes?
Not in birds, typically. Penguins do because they're aquatic.
Oh, okay.
And then, like, in a lot of, like, marine or just aquatic reptiles, things like certain, like, water monitors, they can do that. Others just hold their breath.
Okay.
All right, so that's sort of just the general features. Just large, long-necked birds that walk around on the ground, may or may not have actual movable wings, shaggier-looking feathers. That's the general gist here. So let's actually meet some of the family here. Starting with the most famous ones, which are the ostriches. There are two species, both in the genus Struthio. So there's the common ostrich, which is the one you're thinking of, Struthio camelus, and also the Somali ostrich, which is Struthio molybdophanes. Both are sort of found in the semi-arid regions of Africa, and really the only difference between the two is that the neck and leg skin is pinkish in the common ostrich and kind of bluish in the Somali ostrich, particularly in the males, which is pretty usual for birds. The males tend to be the brighter colored of the two sexes.
Mm-hmm.
Both have your typical black and white feathers, although common ostriches have a collar of white feathers around sort of the base of the neck, while Somali ostriches don't. They also eat different foods, which is why they can sort of overlap in their environments. Common ostriches mainly eat grass, Somali ostriches mainly eat leaves. And as I mentioned before, both species, I think the common ostrich is like marginally bigger, but not really noticeably bigger. But they can both get around 8 feet tall and 200 to 300 pounds, particularly in the big males. Unusual that the males are larger, because typically in most egg-laying things, the females are larger so that they can lay more eggs. But in ostriches, that's not the case anymore. Both are kind of on the watch list for conservation things. Common ostrich is mostly doing fine, but it's kind of isolated a little bit in certain areas. Somali ostrich is mostly on the watch list because of where it lives. It lives in sort of the Horn of Africa, which particularly in recent years has been prone to civil wars. And they are a big source of meat, and also they lay gigantic eggs, which are delicious.
You've eaten one?
So, yes, actually, I have an ostrich egg here in my house. That was a birthday present right before I moved away from California from that ostrich land.
Jeez.
Wow.
Okay. All right. Hold on. Can we discuss this for a minute? Like,
sure thing. Yeah.
So you have an okay. So if I keep like a regular chicken egg, am I, like, eventually I think it's going to go bad. Like, I'm not going to be able to keep that long term. Like,
So we drilled out the bottom. So basically what you do is you drill a hole in the top and bottom, and then you basically just like blow through the top more or less, and all of it squirts out the bottom.
Okay. And the rest of it, like it is hard enough where, okay. Like you, like, could you drop it on the floor and like,
oh no, it'd be fine. It'd break.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Wow. So you had to be careful with that
thing. Yeah. We had to be very careful how we packed it on the move from California.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. It's not quite the size of a football, but getting there. Yeah. It's big.
Incredible. Incredible.
Yeah. Like I said, Somali ostrich currently listed as vulnerable. Because Somalia and then particularly Ethiopia, in the last like year or two, Ethiopia's had, you know, a lot of insecurity going on. So with that kind of thing, food insecurity happens and people are more prone to, doing whatever they have to get food. However, it's not really likely that they'll ever go extinct because they're farmed commercially in Kenya. Which is also part of their native range, but, you know, a generally sort of more stable political country. So it's unlikely they'll go extinct because there's a very large number of ostrich farms there.
Okay, so I have a question.
Yeah.
I may be thinking of the wrong bird, but stereotypically, I have this image in my head of an ostrich burying its head in the sand.
Yes, you're thinking of the right bird. They don't do that, though.
That's not a thing?
No. Because short of... if it weren't for rhinos and elephants, they'd be one of the bigger animals in their environment. So they'll just run away from things. That being said, even though birds are generally rather smart, ratites tend to be pretty dumb. their brain to body size ratio is really small.
Yeah.
So while that, you know, wouldn't be out of character, but to my knowledge, that isn't like a usual behavior for them. But you are thinking of the right bird.
Who made me think this way? Who did this?
Lots of cartoons. That's a very common like cartoon trope.
True.
Cool. So that is the ostriches, the most famous. Next up are probably like the least known of all the living ones, which are called the rheas. These are two or three species, depending on who you ask, all in the genus Rhea, R-H-E-A. There's Rhea americana, the greater Rhea of South America, and also a feral population in northeastern Germany for some reason. Sure. And Rhea pinnata, the lesser Rhea of western and extreme South America, including the Andes Mountains and Patagonia. Which these look extremely similar to ostriches. Their feathers aren't quite as poofy, and they're kind of like brownish gray feathers instead of black and white feathers. They live very similarly to ostriches, sort of in savanna or shrubby environments. They're just smaller. So the greater Rhea gets about 5 feet and 90 pounds, and the lesser gets about 3 feet and, you know, 40 to 60 pounds or so. I thought it was kind of neat because they'll also often herd with deer and cattle for protection. So you're just walking through the savannas of South America and you see some deer pop their head up, and then you also just see some giant bird heads pop up out of the grass.
When you say herd with, is it just like they will sort of be in the same space and not attack the other cattle? Will they like make friends is probably the wrong word, but like, you know, like work with them and integrate into like packs? Like, what does that mean, herding with them?
Mostly just hanging out for protection.
Okay, like existing in the same space, strength in numbers, right? But nothing more than that.
Right. To my knowledge, there's lots of different like hunting relationships between birds and certain mammals, but you know, all of these are herbivorous. So, to my knowledge, it's mostly just like, hey, if I see a predator, I'll let you know. If you see a predator, you let me know.
Okay.
Kind of thing. Yeah, so both basically throughout most of like the southern, like middle to southern part of South America, and neither is particularly in trouble of going extinct. They seem to be doing pretty well. Next up, probably my favorite although kiwis might give them a run. Emus. I know Mike also has a soft spot for emus.
Emus.
Emus, one species in the genus Dromaeus. It's Dromaeus novohollandi, with three subspecies spread across basically the entire continent of Australia. Smaller than ostriches, but still quite large. Around 5 feet tall, 70, 80 pounds or so. Emus, fun fact, flap their tiny wings when they run, which I think is quite cute. Their feathers are kind of like a brownish color to blend into the arid grasses and sands throughout all of Australia. Their necks are mostly feathered, but have light blue skin on the parts that don't have feathers. And they are extremely well adapted to dry weather. Australia, with, you know, the exception of like the extreme northern part of Australia, is very, very dry. So they have unique feathers that absorb heat at the far end to keep it from getting like to the body. And they also help radiate it at the end, you know, closer to the body to help keep it cool. So no other bird has feathers, you know, has evolved feathers quite like that. They have what's called a nictitating membrane on their eyes to keep sand out. It's often called the third eyelid. It's like a see-through eyelid that they can close without actually closing their eyes. Yeah. They have a sharp but relatively soft beak, mostly for eating grass. And conservation-wise, emus famously are doing fabulous. Despite the Australian government's best efforts to reduce the population through machine gun warfare, they're doing great.
Gavin's not kidding about that. Look up the Great Emu War if you ever want a good laugh.
It's wonderful.
Oh, okay. I don't know about this.
Did you not know about this, Fia?
I don't know about this.
Oh.
Yeah, oh, so Fia. In sort of the like the Depression era and a little after, emus are very good at like climbing fences or even just like going through fences and eating crops and stuff. Okay. Yeah. And so it's like, you know, we learn about like the Dust Bowl and stuff here in like American, you know, classrooms, at least I did when I was little. That also happened in other places. And so Australia was having a real tough go of it, and the emus were not helping. They were making things a lot worse. And so the Australian government was like, they issued people guns and ammunition and also told the military, hey, go shoot a bunch of emus. And while they sure did that, the emus nevertheless persisted and continue to be doing fine.
Yeah.
Good for them.
So Australia lost a war against birds,
they sure did.
Which is the way I like to put it. Yeah, it's fantastic. Them and China.
I don't know that one.
Yeah.
China, Mao Zedong, it's a whole thing. We'll talk about it later.
All right. I will note, though, there are several subspecies of emu that lived on islands that were driven extinct by European colonists. So, for example, on Tasmania, the pretty good-sized island to Australia's south, that once had emus, and it no longer does. A number of other emu subspecies on smaller islands were, you know, driven extinct by colonists. So they sure did kill some emus, but not the big ones. Still in that same area of the world, we have the cassowaries, which are definitely the most colorful and bizarre looking of the ratites. So these are three species, all in the genus Cassowaries. There's the southern cassowary, which lives on sort of the southern half of New Guinea, which is, I believe, the second largest island in the world, depending on how you count Greenland. And it's basically directly straight north of Australia. And so the southern half of it has the southern cassowary, as well as the extreme northern parts of Australia that are kind of rainforesty. The northern cassowary, which lives on the northern half of New Guinea, and the dwarf cassowary, which lives sort of in the mountains that divide New Guinea into its northern and southern halves. Cassowaries, if you have not seen them, are very bizarre. Their feathers look very much like very long, kind of oiled up hair, and are jet black. They have five or six long, like very stiff feathers coming off of each, you know, very reduced wing that look kind of similar to porcupine quills, but without the barb at the end. So they just have these like 5 or 6 long shafts sticking out on each side of like noticeably thick, like a rod of hair almost, or a rod of feather. Their necks are featherless and bright blue, but have wattles like a turkey that are bright red.
Whoa.
The northern cassowary varies a bit with that and can have the red wattle coloration be orange or yellow and also extend to cover much of like the throat part of the neck. Weirdly, females tend to be the brighter of the two sexes. They tend to be brighter than males, which is unusual for birds. And they also have a large keratinous horn on the top of their head that's called a helmet. It's sort of slender, sort of like compressed side to side, but covers most of the top of their head in both the males and the females. And so even though these ones are quite closely related to emus, unlike emus, which live in the very dry areas of Australia, cassowaries live in very dense rainforests in New Guinea. And this very small patch of like very rainforested area in northern Australia. 3 species, all of them are currently listed as least concern, but both, so the island of New Guinea is sort of split in half. One half has some provinces of the country of Indonesia on it, and then the other half is the nation of Papua New Guinea. Both of those areas are developing quite quickly these days, and so cassowaries have a habit of wandering into suburbs and being attacked by dogs or hit by cars. So they're technically listed as least concern, but there's some growing concerns about their conservation. And
some
especially
pink flags, one might say.
Yeah, sure are. And then the southern cassowary, the populations that live on Australia itself are also not doing terrific because, like I said, there's only a very small handful of pockets of that very dense forest that they like to live in. And they also are known for being quite mean. They have a reputation for attacking people. As far as I know, I had always heard that, but I don't know how founded that is, according to some of the information I read about them. They do have one of their toenails that's like very long and dagger-like that they used to kick with, but I believe there's only been 2 known cases of it killing somebody.
Okay, so I just Googled this bird really quick. And
so friggin' weird, right?
So weird. So weird. Hopefully, I'm not putting out any spoilers, but I wonder if you have seen this, Gavin. In the Google search of images, there is a YouTube video that says, "Are they the raptor relatives?"
Oh, that's pure clickbait.
Okay. All right.
So cool. The answer is no, apparently.
No, and that's referring to that one large claw that they have on their foot, even though in like velociraptors, it's sort of sickle shaped like a scythe. In this, it's literally just like a long straight nail that they would just stab with when they kick.
Okay.
But there's also, and I won't get into it because I also don't know too much about it, and we have a lot more to talk about, but apparently there is, you know, evidence for humans attempting to domesticate them, like when humans first got to the island of New Guinea trying to domesticate them, and it being one of the first, you know, like earliest documented cases of domestication. Not quite as old as like dogs, but up there in the range of like horses, cattle. To my knowledge, that didn't really take, but it seems like there are records of some kind of selective breeding for their eggs. Next up, we have the other weirdos for the rat types, which are the kiwis. These are the weird little dudes that live in New Zealand.
They're so cute.
They are so cute, but also extremely strange birds. They are generally small and round, with shaggy brown hair-like feathers. Depending on the species, they can range from about 3 to 8 pounds and between 1 and 2 feet tall. So considering some of the other ones, like I said, averaging at 60 to 80 pounds, these guys are just teeny tiny. They have a very long, narrow, kind of tubular beak surrounded by whiskers, which is a very unusual thing for birds to have. Mostly because they, the way they eat, they sort of use their long beak for probing into like the soil, looking for worms and things like that. And they also have their nostrils at the very end of their beak, which no other bird has. All other birds have them sort of at the base of the beak toward the eyes.
Do we know why?
Yeah. Probably because they rely a lot on smell. They also have proportionately the smallest eyes of any bird. And it's often cited that they're mostly nocturnal, but I read some stuff that said that that might just be because we introduced a lot of things to New Zealand that are diurnal that would love to eat them. So if in like sanctuaries and things where there are for sure no predators, because New Zealand naturally should have no real land predators other than some lizards, you know, they will just walk around and behave normally during the day as they would at night. Let's see. They, like I said, they mostly eat things like worms, insects, some seeds occasionally. In some of the bigger species, they'll sometimes even eat smaller lizards and amphibians. Famously, kiwis lay gigantic eggs for their size. They can be as large as a quarter of the weight of the adult kiwi.
Wow.
For comparison, a kiwi, which is about the size of a chicken, lays an egg 6 times the size of a chicken egg.
Yeah, okay.
Kiwis are very unique in that, like I mentioned, they evolved in an environment where they don't have any terrestrial predators, which thanks to humans they now have. All are doing mostly okay, but that's thanks to the government of New Zealand taking really strong actions to protect them. The people of New Zealand are not called Kiwis for nothing. They love these birds. And so those are all of the things that are typically called ratites for things that are alive today. But I will say a quick note about the tinamous. All of these that I've mentioned so far, it's like there are 2 species of ostrich, 2 species of rhea, 1 emu, 3 cassowaries, 5 species of kiwi. So it's like not super diverse in any of these groups. But tinamous, there are 47 species in 9 genera, which for birds is not all that diverse. But considering they can fly and then become isolated from one another, that's why there are more species of them. All of them, you know, live across South America and Southern Central America. And these can range in a variety of sizes too, all the way from 4.5 pounds down to 1.5 ounces.
Whoa.
So real small birds.
Jeez.
Yeah. And generally, like I mentioned, look kind of like a slender turkey or a chicken. They seem to be able to fly decently well, like a bit better than a turkey. But like I said earlier, they just kind of prefer not to. And the reason I mention them is because they are included in this group, but do not fit all the things that I mentioned earlier. And then before we talk about sort of their evolution, there are 2 more that I want to talk about that are now extinct because they're really interesting. They are the elephant birds of Madagascar and the moas of New Zealand. Both were giant birds that basically filled the giant herbivore niche of their environment. Moas were very tall, getting easily over 10 feet and weighing about the same as a female grizzly bear, give or take a bit, about 400 pounds. With the largest species, there were smaller species as well. There were 9 species from that giant size down to about the size of like a pretty big turkey. And then elephant birds were a bit shorter but had much heavier bodies, with the lower estimate for the largest species being about 600 pounds. That's the low estimate, which is about as heavy as a male grizzly bear. The average estimate is about 1,500 pounds, which is about in the same range as a bison.
Wow.
Yeah. And this is a bird.
Yeah, right.
And the reason that I want to mention them is because, A, they're very famous. Namely, because both groups only went extinct about 1,300 years ago. So around 700 AD.
Jeez.
Yeah. You know, you hear often that, like, mammoths were still around when the pyramids were built or something like that. These things, you know, could have said hi to Jesus. these things outlived, you know, the Spartans and the Athens, or Athenians. Yeah, these guys were around for a long time. And went extinct very quickly when humans got to their respective islands. And not just colonists, like the original, like, native folks who live there. All right, so now into their evolution. And the reason why you may be looking at the clock right now and thinking, Gavin, your episodes are normally about an hour, and we're already at over 45 minutes. It's because despite them being big birds, we don't have a ton of fossils of them. Because after all, they are still birds. And birds generally have more fragile skeletons. Some of them tend to live in places that don't preserve fossils very well, such as, like, forests do not produce particularly good fossils, just because the rate of decomposition is relatively high. But that's not to say we have nothing. And I'll get to that. So this whole group, with both the big birds and the tinamous, scientifically are called the paleognaths, which means old mouth, which is a reference to that weird sort of palate that they have in their mouth. All other birds that are alive today are in another group called the neognaths, the new mouths, because they don't have this kind of palate. That means, basically, that the split between this group of birds we're talking about here and all other birds happened very early in bird evolution. So, based on genetics, it seems like this happened in the early Cretaceous period, somewhere in the ballpark of 100 to 110 million years ago. But we don't really have any fossils to show this group until about 70 million years ago. So there's a 30 to 40 million year gap where they probably were around, but we don't really see them. And I'd also like to take this point to point out that not all giant flightless birds are ratites. Several other groups have evolved doing this as well. For example, in South America, on top of the rayas that live there currently, there were the terror birds, which were giant carnivorous birds.
Incredible name.
Oh, for sure. There's also, and those persisted right up until, like, only 2 or 3 million years ago in South America. And then right after the dinosaurs went extinct in Europe, there were a number of large flightless herbivorous birds as well, that are completely unrelated to ratites here. Birds like to not be able to fly. Flying costs a lot of energy, so if they cannot do that, they will not do that. The first group of paleognaths, so this larger ratite group, we see a fully flighted group. So they have that palate, which is why we know they're in this group, but they're just a regular bird. It's a group called the lithorniths, and they sort of resemble like a heron or a crane, but with sort of a proportionately shorter neck. So a relatively standard-looking bird, by all accounts. And that's, like I said, you know, around 70 million years ago or so. And after that, things kind of get fuzzy, because, like I mentioned, they're still birds that don't leave good fossils. But most of what we know about the rest of their history is from genetics, because some people decided, hey, these birds are real weird, we should probably try to learn some things about them. And the 2000s have been an excellent time for doing genetic studies on weird animals. It had generally been thought that, you know, tinamous, because they can fly, that they were sort of the early stage, and that flightlessness evolved once, and that all of the ones that can't fly are more closely related to each other, and the tinamous are sort of, you know, a step off of that. And they thought that, you know, this flightlessness, like I said, evolved once, and then these ancestors walked their way around the world. Because if you noticed while we were talking, all of these birds live in the southern hemisphere.
Yep.
And so back in ye olden times of the Cretaceous, there was a giant supercontinent that encompassed pretty much all of the southern continents called Gondwana, which we've talked about a ton of times on this podcast.
I was going to say that's that you know rings a big bell, several bells.
Absolutely. And so this supercontinent is less famous than Pangaea, but still very famous. It contains South America, Africa, Antarctica, Australia, New Zealand, India, and you know, throughout the Cretaceous period, and then later on, a little bit afterward, this would continue to break up to, you know, the continents would move to where we see them today. However, it was kind of thought that Gondwana, you know, was still close enough together, even though the bits and pieces might have been broken up a bit. They were still close enough that, like, a big storm could have washed a handful of these ancestors out to whatever continent they originated on, to, say, Africa, which split relatively early. So that was what kind of made sense in the minds of these scientists before these genetic studies happened. But in 2007, a group of scientists wanted to do a very, very large-scale genetic study of basically as many bird species as they could get DNA for. And this study and lots of genetic studies since have put tinamous not sort of at the outside of all the flightless ones, but right in the middle. Which means that flightlessness must have evolved at least six separate times in this one group of birds.
You say at least, like, is there an upper limit to that? Like between 6 and 10, or is it just like 6 and, you know, who knows?
From what I could tell, technically 7.
Okay.
So 6 or 7 times. So ostriches, rheas, moas, the giant ones on New Zealand that are extinct, kiwis, elephant birds, the giant ones on Madagascar that are extinct, and the common ancestor of emus and cassowaries all did it on their own. Mm-hmm. And so that was, I can't imagine how much work that study must have been, because it would be a lot of work to do thousands of species DNA, like a phylogeny, sort of a tree of life. It would be a lot of work to do that now, let alone in 2007.
Yeah.
And so in the years after that, more studies were done with the elephant bird and the moa DNA, because since they went extinct so recently, we still have a lot of, like, really viable DNA from them. And so it was kind of assumed that since moas and kiwis both lived on New Zealand, that they were closely related to each other. That kind of makes sense, as much as New Zealand is kind of seen by people who don't live there as like Australia's little brother. New Zealand is quite far from Australia, so they're not exactly, like, they're technically neighbors, but it's like a neighbor out in the country, where it's like they're the closest person that lives next to you, but they're still really far. And it was also kind of thought that the elephant birds, which, like I said, lived on Madagascar, were closely related to ostriches, because ostriches live in Eastern Africa. But no, says the DNA, it turns out that moas were more closely related to the tinamous, all the way over in South America.
What in the world?
And even weirder, that kiwis were the most close relative to the elephant birds in Madagascar. So the only way for this to have made sense is if their ancestors could have flown to these weird places. Because as much as, you know, those giant ostrich legs are made for walking, you can't walk that far across an ocean.
Tends to not be how things work.
Right. And so all of this sort of supports the idea that all of these various populations were at one time flighted, and then got to these islands, or the continent of Africa, and then, lost the ability to fly, because particularly on New Zealand, if there's no ground predators, why would you not lose your wings? Because flying, like I said, is very energetically costly. So that is sort of 2007 through about 2020. And then lastly, just, you know, relatively recently in 2020, a genetic study was done to try and place a timeline for when sort of each group split and then became flightless. So ostriches sort of split off first, not too long after the end Cretaceous mass extinction, so around 56 million years ago. The rheas split off next, a few million years later. The group that contains kiwis and elephant birds split around that time too. And then the emu and cassowary group split off from the tinamou and moas around 45 million years ago. So even though things like ostriches and rheas look quite similar, they've been separated for more than 55 million years. And unfortunately, we'll likely never know exactly how each group got to be sort of where they are today, because as flighted birds, their ancestors were all the worse at leaving fossils for us to find. But this is, I think, a really good example of how genetics can sort of make up the gaps that we have in the fossil record. I have a bit of a history of kind of dumping on the geneticists occasionally on this podcast, because sometimes they say things that to a paleontologist don't make sense. There's a long-running debate on hippos and whales with geneticists and paleontologists, because whales, their closest living relatives are hippos. And while we have all these wonderful transitional fossils of how whales, you know, went from hooved things on land to the whales we see today, we should, according to the geneticists, find hippo fossils like 25 million years before we actually do. And it's not a lack of good fossil sites. We have those where hippos should be, but they just aren't there. And the geneticists just say, well, keep looking. They must be there. The paleontologists are just like, I really don't think they are. So as
but
much
in this
as
case...
yes, in this case, when the genetics are literally all we have, sometimes you just have to take their word for it.
That was almost a compliment.
Yes, a very backhanded compliment, and I very much meant it that way.
As yeah. only you can.
Why, thank you. But yeah, so that is this weird group of birds that just take everything stereotypical about a bird and do the opposite. Birds are tiny, sing-songy, flying things, and ratites are giant monsters that will kick you to death in a small handful of recorded cases.
We have a small number of recorded cases on our backlog because this has been episode 116 of I Wish You Were Dead, a podcast about things that used
wonderful.
To be alive. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. My name is Mike. That is Gavin. That was also Fia. We will see you guys in 2 weeks. Until then, take care, everybody.
This episode of I Wish You Were Dead was written by Gavin Davidson and hosted by Gavin Davidson, Mike Bryson, and Finella Campanino. It was sound edited and edited for YouTube by Gavin Davidson. Special thanks to former guests of the pod and to listeners like you.